Morning, I'd like to turn our attention to events in 1 Samuel chapters 8 and 12 and in related passages. Start off by observing that though the Old Testament and its particular laws are not legally binding upon us as Christians today, so teaches Hebrews 7 verse 12, where we're told that there is a change of law, that is from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Nevertheless, the Old Testament teaches principles which do carry over into the New Testament, or reincorporated, you might say, into the New Testament, and therefore are equally applicable to Christians, and I might say even critical to their salvation. Romans 15:4 and 1 Corinthians 10:11 teach that, but I'll just use 2 Timothy 3 verse 15 as a representative passage to that effect. So really what I'm doing is defending my reliance upon the Old Testament, as I'm going to do today, to teach principles that are critically important to us as Christians. It's not inconsistent for us to appeal to the Old Testament for the lessons that it holds for us. For instance, in 2 Timothy 3:15, Paul says to Timothy, "And that from childhood you have known the sacred writings, which are able to give you the wisdom that leads to salvation through faith, which is in Christ Jesus." The sacred writings there that Timothy had known from childhood would have to be the Old Testament writings, because actually, at this point, the New Testament is still in the process of being written, and so when he was a child, perhaps, I don't know, maybe 20 years before this time, what he had available to him in terms of sacred writings was the Old Testament. Paul is really saying the Old Testament then gives you the wisdom that leads to salvation. So, need I say more? The Old Testament is very important for our study. So, today then, we're going to look at one of the stories from the Old Testament, and that is the story of the Israelites' demand for a king in 1 Samuel the 8th chapter and in related passages. That story holds some critically important lessons for us. And we need to ask the question, why was it wrong for the Israelites to ask for, really demand or insist upon having a king? Well, a very important lesson which the Israelites' demand for a king teaches, and this is very important for us as Christians, is that doing other than what God commands is sinful. When God commands us to do something, and we do something else, we substitute something else for it, that's very wrong. And the Israelites' demand for a king teaches that lesson. Well, toward the end of Samuel's life, the Israelites demanded a king, as we see in 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter. Let's look at verses 1 through 5 of that chapter. Samuel was the last of the 14 judges of Israel. And apparently he had become so old that he was allowing his sons to step in for him and act as judges in his place. Samuel was a good man. He was a good judge, but his sons were corrupt. And that served as an occasion, at least in 1 Samuel 8 as it's portrayed, for the Israelites to ask for a king. But starting with verse 1 of 1 Samuel 8, we read, "And it came about when Samuel was old that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abijah. They were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, 'Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations.'" So there you have it. Now, prior to the Israelites having kings to rule them, God had arranged for the Israelites to be led by judges. You have a little bit of encapsulated history of how the Israelites were, of course, led out of Egypt to the verge of the land of Canaan by Moses, and then actually conquered the land of Canaan under the leadership of Joshua. And after Joshua died, then God gave them judges to lead them. I would not say rule them, because rulership is probably too strong a term for what the judges did, but at least they were leaders. So that it says, and I'm going back to verse 20, after speaking of the conquest of Canaan, Paul says in Acts 13, verse 20, "And after these things, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet." So Samuel was the last of the judges. Now, Israel's government under judges was relatively simple. It appears to have been what we might speak of today as decentralized. You'd probably have a hard time during the period of the judges putting your finger on the map and saying this city was the capital of Israel. That was untrue. Once you get to the kings, they established capital cities. But now, it's hard to say what city would have been the capital of Israel. That's how decentralized or simple the government was. It was limited, and it was relatively weak. Though judges would initially come to the rescue of the Israelites at times by leading a militia army to overthrow foreign invaders who oppressed them, the main task of the judges was to render judicial decisions among the Israelites. Now, by way of a comparison, today under the government of the United States, rulership is divided up among three branches of government: the legislative branch in the Congress, the executive branch in the president and his staff, or administration, and then the third branch is the judiciary, which ultimately is represented by the Supreme Court of the United States, so that power is divided up among these three branches. And the power of the judiciary has grown throughout U.S. history, but it could be relatively weak because the judiciary would be dependent upon the executive branch to carry out its decisions, and the executive branch has to be cooperative. There have been times, and especially in the early history of the United States, when that was not the case. I'm really speaking about the weakness of judges now. We may not think of them as being very weak now, but there have been times in history, even in the history of the United States, when judges have not necessarily been that powerful. There's the classic example of when the United States wanted to remove the American Indians out of states like Georgia, and particularly, move them out west to what is now Oklahoma, and a case was brought on their behalf before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in their behalf, and the Chief Justice was John Marshall, and Andrew Jackson was the president, and Andrew Jackson didn't like that the Supreme Court under John Marshall had ruled in favor of the Indians, and he simply said, that is, Andrew Jackson simply said, "John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it." In other words, "I'm not going to do what the Supreme Court says." Now, that sort of thing today would get a president impeached, but at that time, this was back before the Civil War in the relatively early 1800s, the Supreme Court had not yet acquired that aura of power. And so I'm just using that as an example to emphasize that judges don't have the power of kings. And that's important to understanding the background of this lesson. Judges among the Israelites did not possess the power necessary to consolidate the tribes so as to face their enemies and guard their territorial integrity with united front. I'm saying all of this to say, why was it that the Israelites weren't happy with the judges and they wanted a king? Because they didn't see the judges as being able to secure what they wanted, to make them safe from their enemies particularly. The judges did not maintain, control, and direct standing armies, and therefore the Israelites were often beset by enemies who would invade and dominate them. And hence, the Israelites, because the judges could be so weak, sometimes just simply ignored what the judges had to say. The judges were not strong leaders. For this point, let's go to Judges 2, verses 16 and 17, to see that sometimes the Israelites just didn't listen to the judges. If you didn't listen to the king, you might lose your head, but that's not going to happen with the judge because the judge is a weaker ruler. Judges 2, verses 16 and 17, "Then the Lord raised up judges who delivered them from the hands of those who plundered them. And yet they did not listen to their judges, for they played the harlot after other gods and bowed themselves down to them. They turned aside quickly from the way in which their fathers had walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do as their fathers." So they just didn't listen to their judges, particularly in spiritual matters, and perhaps not in other matters either. So Then, eventually, in the latter years of Samuel, the typical cyclical event occurs. I say cyclical because they went through these cycles of apostasy and restoration, rescue from their oppressors, and then after a while they would get simple again, oppressors would come back. But now we have Nahash, the king of Ammon, threatens one of their cities, Jabesh-Gilead, in 1 Samuel 11. And they now think that it's time for a king. Now, earlier in the text, in 1 Samuel 8, they attribute their asking for a king to the fact that Samuel's sons, Joel and Abijah, were corrupt. But actually what we find out later on is that there was something else motivating them to ask for a king. And that was this threat from Nahash, king of the Ammonites. We know that because that's what Samuel says. So if we go to Samuel 12, verse 12, we see that that is the case. This is after Saul had already been selected as their king. Samuel speaking there says, "When you saw that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came against you, you said to me, 'No, but a king shall reign over us, although the Lord your God was your king.'" So, perhaps the bigger reason that they wanted a king was they were feeling threatened again. Before, when the Israelites wanted to defend themselves against their enemies, what they would do is raise what we call a militia. Now, a militia is not a regular standing army, not a trained professional army. People just come from their private homes, and they deal with the problem at the moment. And then when the problem has been resolved by the invader being repelled or whatever, then what happens? They go back to their homes. They go back to being private citizens. A king, though, what would a king do? It would be his primary job to guard the territorial integrity of his kingdom, to keep his people safe. And he would raise a standing army, a professional army. So really it seems that that's what is primarily motivating the Israelites in asking for a king. Yet the advantage of kings was also their disadvantage. Why is that? Okay, you think of the kings as being strong. Now, that strength is good as long as they use it to protect you, but sometimes the power that kings acquire to protect their subjects can also be used to oppress or lead astray their subjects. So, kings, as a matter of fact, eventually became so powerful that they not only oppressed their subjects, this is ultimately what led to the division of the Israelites into the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. But kings also tended to displace God in his control over them. And this is seen in the fact that of Israel's first three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon, only David remained faithful to God. And then after the division of the kingdom, in 1 Kings 12, all of the kings of the northern kingdom of Israel were unfaithful, and some of the kings of Judah were unfaithful, and they led God's people astray. Ultimately, as we could see in 2 Kings 17, in the case of the northern kingdom, they were taken off into Assyrian captivity, and it was because their kings led their people astray from God. Now, I've said all of this because I think it's very helpful in helping us to understand why God condemned Israel for insisting on king. So we're going back to the earlier question. What was so bad about the Israelites asking for a king? It's just a form of government. I mean, we have kings in various nations still today. Monarchy was a very common form of government at that time and place. So what's wrong with the Israelites asking for a king too? Well, to put it in a nutshell, insistence on having a king effectively dethroned God. And that's the way it is brought out in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 7. It says there, after the Israelites had asked for a king, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them." So really what they're saying is, okay, you've been our king, but you've not been a very effective king here, so we need a human king. And again in chapter 10, verse 19, Samuel says to the Israelites, but you today rejected your God who delivered you from all your calamities and your distresses, yet you have said no, but set a king over us. Now therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans. And then finally, along these lines, over in chapter 12, verse 12, Samuel again speaking there says, now when you saw that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us, although the Lord your God was your king. So there you have it. What's the problem with the Israelites asking for a king? They're displacing God. They're dethroning God. Now, of course, I'm sure that they don't think of it in these terms, but if you take the long view of Israelite history and see how they went astray from God, that's the case. They were dethroning God. So this made their demand for a king not only wickedness, but great wickedness. Now, I want you to see from a biblical perspective, from the perspective of God and Samuel, his prophet, and this was really bad. This wasn't just a little bad. This was really, really bad. To see that, we need to go to 1 Samuel 12. Samuel, in verse 17 of 1 Samuel 12, not only said that it was wickedness for them to ask for a king, but it was great wickedness. So let's read 1 Samuel 12, verse 17. Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call the Lord that he may send thunder and rain. Then you will know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord by asking for yourselves a king. So while we might think of it as being a small thing, and we might not be able to understand why God thought it was so bad for them to ask for a king, it was bad in his eyes. It was great wickedness. And even the people finally realized that this was the case. But before that, God confirmed Samuel's assessment that their asking for a king was great wickedness by sending thunder and rain on their wheat harvest at Samuel's request. Now, this was a very critical time in the crop year of the Israelites. The wheat was just about ready to be harvested, and the weather really needed to be something close to perfect at that time. You don't want hail, you don't want rain, even you don't want thunderstorms when you're trying to harvest wheat. It will disrupt the harvest. And the harvest really gets disrupted and ruined. That could mean people go hungry or even starve. So this is very critical. But he says in verse 17, is it not that wheat harvest today? I won't read it again, but dropping it down to verse 18, it says, so Samuel called to the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. So this is the Lord's way of attesting to the truthfulness of Samuel's assessment that their wickedness in asking for a king was great. But then even the people, after the thunder and the rain, finally recognized their request as evil, and they even put it on the same level as idolatry by saying that they had added their demand for a king to all their other evil, which was idolatry. So let's read verse 19. Then all the people said to Samuel, pray for your servants to the Lord your God so that we may not die, for we have added to all our sins this evil by asking for ourselves a king. And then in the next verse, verse 20, Samuel confirms that, yeah, you're right in calling it evil. Verse 20, and Samuel said to the people, do not fear. You have committed all this evil. Yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. So is there any question then from the perspective of God, their request for a king, really a demand for a king, was sinful? And yet, it is not obvious why their demand for a king was such great wickedness. Because there was no specific prohibition in the law of Moses against their having a king. You can read the law of Moses from one end to the other, unless I've missed it. There simply is no specific prohibition to the effect, you shall not have a king. And I emphasize that because, again, we're back to the question, what was wrong with it? I've already answered that to some extent. But let me move on. from the point that there was no specific prohibition in the law of Moses against them having a king. In fact, if you go to Deuteronomy 17, what we're going to find is that God gives regulations for the king there. And when a person reads those regulations, if he's not careful, he could think, oh, this is God saying it's okay for them to have a king. This is God giving them permission to have a king. If you want a king, fine. That's the way some people would read it. They would read these regulations as implying that they were free to have this king. And let's just read at least one verse here. These regulations for the king start in verse 14 of Deuteronomy 17. Now let me read at least verse 14. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the other nations who are around me, in verse 15, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. And I'll stop right there. I think I've read enough of that for my point right now. Ultimately, he will go on and say, here's three things that the king cannot multiply. He cannot multiply wives, cannot multiply horses, and he cannot multiply wealth. And Solomon, of course, multiplied all three of those things. And then in the last paragraph, beginning verse 18 of Deuteronomy 17, he says, the king, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, then he shall write a copy of the law. Now imagine that. That's a lot of writing. Something like, I don't know if it meant all the way from Genesis 1 to last chapter in Deuteronomy, but at least parts of those books, which collectively are called the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, that's a big job. And taking pen in hand and writing all that down. And not only that, but he's told he has to keep that law by him. He's supposed to have access to it. It's like the Lord is recognizing eventually these kings are going to have a problem in not keeping my law. And I want to prevent that. But when a person just reads, beginning with verse 14 of Deuteronomy 17 about these regulations from the king, I can imagine that a person could see that as implying it's okay for you to have a king. Actually, this is not God's approval of them. He does not say, you shall set a king over you, but when you do set a king over you. So there is a significant difference there. But the fact that the Israelites looked at it this way too, as giving them permission, is shown from the fact that they actually quote from Deuteronomy 17. Verse 14, it says, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations around me. Those are the words that they use in 1 Samuel 7. Give us a king like all the nations. So, apparently the Israelites have gone back to Deuteronomy 17 and they're thinking this too, that, oh, God's giving us permission there. It's time for us to have a king. However, really this is an unjustifiable implication to imply from the regulations regarding kings in Deuteronomy 17 that is God's permission to have a king. Now, that's an unjustifiable implication. Why? Well, this legislation in Deuteronomy 17, beginning with verse 14, is what is typically called contingency legislation. In other words, if you do this, not that I want you to do this, but if you do it, this is what's going to happen. It's like saying, if a person commits this crime, this will be his sentence. That's not permission to commit the crime, is it? But if you do commit the crime, this is what's going to happen to you. So this command in Deuteronomy 17 is not a command for them to have a king. It's not permission for them to have a king. It's what we would call contingency legislation, which was given to accommodate and ameliorate a situation on which the people themselves insisted. A comparable example of that, and I give it in Exodus 21:10 and Deuteronomy 21, beginning with verse 15, is legislation regarding the treatment of polygamous wives, how their husbands were to treat them if a husband had more than one wife. Well, that's not giving permission for polygamy. You're just saying, if you men do acquire more than one wife, I'm not saying it's all right, but if you do acquire more than one wife, here's the way you have to treat them. That's just another example of contingency legislation. The fact that God was to give them judges for their needs, but in contrast, they would ask for a king shows that actually the kings were the Israelites' idea, not God's idea. God gave them judges. He didn't give them kings until essentially they demanded kings. Again, the passage in Acts 13, beginning with verse 20, says God gave them Judges. So, again, what was fundamentally wrong with the Israelites' demand for a king then was that God had never commanded or authorized a king in the law of Moses. That's important. What was wrong with their having a king? Because God gave them something, namely the judges, while he himself was the king, and they said, no, we need some other arrangement. God never commanded or authorized a king in the law of Moses. And therefore, a lack of a command or authorization was effectively or as strong as a specific prohibition against having a king. And I really want to emphasize this. This is very important for our interpretation of the Scriptures, our understanding of the Scriptures, and how we live as Christians and what we practice, particularly in our worship. There are people, for instance, who will wonder, well, why don't we have instrumental accompaniment to our singing in worship? Simply because God never authorized it. God never commanded it. If you go to passages like Ephesians 5:19 and Colossians 3:16, you will see that we're commanded to sing. The question then becomes, can we do something besides sing? No. God said sing, and he didn't authorize anything else, particularly musical instruments in our worship. And that's the classic example, but you could go on and on and on. Can we burn incense in worship to God? No. Why not? He didn't say not to. He didn't say it's sinful to burn incense any more than he specifically prohibited instrumental music in worship. The point is, he effectively did that when he didn't authorize it. And that's illustrated in the fact here that God, even though he never said to the Israelites, you shall not have a king, on the other hand, he never said they could have a king either. When God had not commanded something, it was simple to have it or do it. For instance, though there are many prohibitions of idolatry or the worship of other gods in the Old Testament, the fact that God had not commanded the worship of other gods or idols was what made it wrong. Now, we've been here in Deuteronomy 17. Look with me. This is interesting because it gets into the worship of other gods and idolatry. In chapter 17, beginning with verse 2, if there is found in your midst, in any of your towns which the Lord your God is giving you, a man or woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God by transgressing his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, or the sun, or the moon, or any of the heavenly hosts, which I have not commanded. And if it is told you, and you have heard of it, then you shall investigate thoroughly. And behold, if it is true, and the thing certain, that the detestable thing has been done in Israel, then you shall bring out that man or that woman who has done this evil deed to your gates, that is, the man or the woman, and you shall stone them to death. Several times, maybe around half dozen times, that expression, not commanded, is used in the Scriptures. Here's one of those times. He says at the end of verse 3, which I have not commanded. Idolatry was fundamentally wrong because God had not commanded or authorized it. Now sure, there are specific prohibitions against many of them. But even before that, it was wrong. Because God had not commanded it. God had said, you worship me. And when he said, you worship me, that cuts out the sun and the moon and the heavenly host and any other idols or false gods. Right there and then. And we need to appreciate that. I say that because God had not commanded them to have a king. Now, as we've seen later on in Deuteronomy 17 here, he points out that, in effect, if you're going to insist upon a king, then here's what you do. But that's not a command for them to have a king. That's not authorization for them to have a king. As a matter of fact, not much later on in the next chapter, we have the same use of that expression, not commanded. Let's look in verse 20 of Deuteronomy 18. It's really addressing the subject of false prophets here. But it says, but the prophet who shall speak a word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, on which he shall speak in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. Just for a prophet to speak in the name of God without authorization Mm-hmm. That's wrong. That makes it sinful. As a matter of fact, so sinful it says, that prophet shall die. That's how serious doing something that God has not commanded. And in Jeremiah, there are several passages to that effect also. So there were other sins that were identified as such by virtue of the fact that God had not commanded, he had not authorized them. And all of this is illustrated in the fact that the Israelites were wrong in asking for a king, because nowhere in the law were they authorized or commanded by God to have a king. Now, some people may think, oh, this is just silly reasoning. Well, no, it's not. This is the same sort of reasoning that Jesus and other Bible characters used in their approach to understanding the Bible. Let me give you an example of that. In Matthew, the 12th chapter, we see that because God had said Aaron and his sons were to eat the tabernacle bread, in the Old Testament called the showbread, though he did not specifically prohibit others from eating it, nevertheless, Jesus was able to say that it was unlawful when David and his companions ate it. This is important. Important enough just to read it from the text, word for word. Let's go to Matthew, the 12th chapter. In verse 3, Jesus responds to the accusation or the charge of the Pharisees by saying, but he said to them, have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of God, and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests alone. Now, there is no specific prohibition against others than Aaron's sons, the priests, eating this bread. But simply because God had specified that Aaron and his sons, the priests, were to eat it, that excluded others automatically. So that Jesus was able to say that it was unlawful. Why? Why was it unlawful? Because it was not commanded or authorized. Those who were authorized were specified. So it was unlawful, Jesus says, for David and his companions to eat it. And then, on top of that, Jesus also inserts a word that the original legislation does not have in it. He inserts the word only. Only the priest were to eat it. Thus showing that all those not included in the specified eaters, Aaron and his sons, the priest, were thereby excluded. It's typically what we call the principle of exclusion. In other words, when some are specified, when some are included, all those not specified are excluded automatically. Even if that is not specifically stated, that's the inference. By the way, the historical background for this incident is in 1 Samuel 21st chapter, but the legislation is in Leviticus 24, verses 5 through 9. When I'm speaking of legislation, I'm talking about God's law regarding the creation of this bread of the presence, as it was called in some versions, and especially verse 9. So, Jesus, it is interesting to note, adds a word that is not in the original text in Leviticus 24, verse 9. He adds the word only. He says, it's only for the priest. Well, what justified him in saying that? Because the priests were the only ones who were specified. Now, God has specified that he was to be the king. Now, when God specifies something, that excludes others from being king. Let's look in Deuteronomy 33, verses 4 and 5. We're just applying the same principle that Jesus used here, that when certain ones are specified, the others are excluded. So, in Deuteronomy 33, verses 4 and 5, we read, Moses charged us with a law, a possession for the assembly of Jacob. And he, that's referring to God there, and he was king in Jeshurun. Jeshurun is another name for the Israelites. God is the one who is specified as being the king in Israel. That's why I say, going back to the beginning, when the Israelites demanded a human king, they were making the demand that was not commanded, not authorized, and they were displacing God with a human king, even if they did not realize that. Now, that was clear to some people. Gideon understood this, even though his people wanted him to be king. No, he cannot be king. Why? Because God was the king of the Israelites. So this was not a point that was lost on Gideon. It was not obscure to him. Let's read in Judges 8, verses 22 and 23. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." Now, when they say rule over us, you and your son, that's establishing a dynasty there. That's the thing. You be our king. Let's see how Gideon responds in verse 23. But Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you." Why, Gideon? He goes on to answer that. "The Lord shall rule over you." And he was right. He understood that I can't be king. You may want me to be king, but I'm not authorized to be king. Why? Because God, the specified king. And therefore, the Israelites' demand for a king was simple because a human king had been excluded by virtue of the fact that God was their specified king. That's a principle that we need to bear in mind. We certainly do. In conclusion, God was really adequate as the king of the Israelites, as long as they obeyed him. The reason they started asking for a human king is because they hadn't really worked the plan. The plan was for them to be faithful to God, their king, and as long as they were, things would go well. But when they started to drift away from their king, then things got bad, and they thought, oh, we can fix that by having a human king. Let's look in 1 Samuel, the 12th chapter, verses 6 through 11 here. And note that that is the case. This is God's plan that they had violated. Then Samuel said to the people, "It is the Lord who appointed Moses and Aaron and who brought your fathers up from the land of Egypt. So now take your stand that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous acts of the Lord which he did for you and your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt and your fathers cried out to the Lord, then the Lord sent Moses and Aaron who brought your fathers out of Egypt and settled them in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God, so he sold them into the hand of Sisera, captain of the army of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. And they cried out to the Lord and said, 'We have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and have served the Baals and the Ashtaroth, but now deliver us from the hands of the enemies and we will serve you.' Then the Lord sent Jerubbaal and Bedan and Japheth and Samuel and delivered you from the hands of your enemies all around so that you lived in security." He's just summarizing what has happened here. Every time the Israelites were in trouble, if they cried out to God, God would help them. God would do what is necessary. God would provide for them. God would provide deliverance for them. He brought them out of Egypt under the leadership of Moses. They conquered the land of Canaan under the leadership of Joshua. Then they would periodically forget God. He would bring oppression upon them from all these nations, some of whom he mentions. And then they would cry out to God. And what would God do? He would send judges to deliver them, some of whom he names here. So in other words, what's the problem here? The problem is the Israelites' disobedience. It's not that God's plan doesn't work. God's plan works if you work the plan. But the Israelites wouldn't do that because they would sometimes become unfaithful to the Lord and then they would fall into problems. And then what's going to happen? Oh, they think that they're going to fix a problem with more of a problem. And that's the last point I want to make. This story of the Israelites' demand for a king shows that when disobedience is a person's problem, resorting to more disobedience is not the solution to the problem of disobedience. Sin cannot be cured by sin itself. You think that's pretty simple. People don't want to understand that, but they don't. One person murders another person, and then he decides, well, but, oh, there are witnesses here, so I better murder them too. Make it worse. Solve the problem by killing the witnesses. Isn't that the way human beings are? They have a problem, and they resort to more of the problem that caused the problem to begin with as a solution to that problem. No. If people are disobedient, more disobedience is not going to help. If the Israelites have been unfaithful to the Lord, and as a result, the Ammonites are attacking them, calling for a king, more sin, more disobedience, is not going to help them with their problem. Now, that eventually became clear, because Saul became unfaithful to the Lord, and Solomon became unfaithful to the Lord. Then lots of the kings became unfaithful to the Lord, and led the people astray so that they went off into Babylonian and Assyrian captivities. It may be that there's at least one person today who haven't heard what I've had to say, or perhaps what others have said in recent times to them, might feel then the need for obedience to the gospel of Jesus Christ. If that is the case with you, we would happily receive you and encourage you. We're going to stand in just a moment for that very purpose, to sing to encourage you, anyone who might be at all inclined to obey the gospel. If you are, come forward in faith and in repentance, confess before us your faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, and be immersed, baptized in the body of water for the forgiveness of your sins. If you've done that at some time in the past, but since then have fallen away and wish to come back, and even to tell us that you're sorry for your sins by way of asking for our encouragement, our forgiveness, we would happily receive you. Won't you come as together for your encouragement? We now stand and sing.